Welcome to Transition State on CITR 101.9 FM.
War crimes will be prosecuted. War criminals will be punished. And it will be no defense to say, I was just following orders.
Proceedings, past his soul to the canvas that cloaked his twisted face to stain. His orange jumps to the rail with such rare distinction he was a stain. The evidence of the standing retribution. What made us of a kingdom come? Those days are gone. Nothing more than a number of attacking things with shareholders and engineers. The emperor's politicians for profiteers.
Hello, radio fans. You're listening to Transition State on CITR 101.9. That was Propagandy with Iteration. We have a very special episode for you this week. As usual, we're going to be talking pharmaceutical science know-how. But this week, we have a very special guest. He is the head of UBC's PharmD department. He is basically the one and only Dr. Peter Lowen. Welcome, Dr. Lowen.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for inviting me to be here.
I feel like me... Oh, now I got your mic on.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for inviting me to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. I think I want to start by giving like a brief story of sort of how I got you here.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm Adam. Some listeners might not know, but I'm a pharmacy student. I'm in the third year of studying pharmacy here at UBC. And me and Dr. Lowen go way back. Do you remember when we first met?
Oh, gosh, do we.
When did we first meet?
Wasn't it 1986?
Yes, yes. You were wearing bell bottoms.
That's correct, because that's what people wore in the 80s. And I think I walking down the road? I had my Sony Walkman in my hand.
Yes.
I think I was spinning a tape. It was the Cars, Heartbeat City.
The Cars, yes.
I was on track 3, which I'm fairly certain is... No, it was the first track, Hello Again. And there you were. You were coming down the road in your yellow T-shirt, your Expo 86 T-shirt. You had your season's pass sticking out of your pocket. Actually, it was on a lanyard, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Is this ringing any bells?
Absolutely. I remember it like it was yesterday. I asked you what you were doing. You said you were pondering whether to go to community or clinical. And I told you, you know, try for the residency. Clinical is the future.
And you changed my life right there. With those simple words, Adam, I was never the same again. And the trajectory of my life, speaking of trajectories, was forever altered. And I thought, you know, 30, 40 years later, I thought, well, maybe someday, you know, Adam will really be something. And I'll be lucky enough to be able to come on his show, which I am certain he will have of some sort. I didn't envision it would be a radio show. I thought it might be more of a traveling minstrel, kind of a circus type of a setup for you. But here we are, all these years later.
And the impressive thing was that I was only 6 years old at the time. So that's pretty, you know, prescient for me.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel. Like, that was the only time that my life has been transformed by the advice I received from a six-year-old.
Yeah, I was, okay, a very advanced six-year-old, though, mind you.
You did have the glasses already at that point, and you wore them well.
So after that, you did your residency at UBC Children's, correct?
After what?
After I recommended it to you.
After I got my are we talking about my life story here now?
The real story.
Oh, okay.
You went to UBC Pharmacy.
I did my degree in pharmacy at UBC, and then I did a residency at Children's and Women's. And then I did the UBC Doctor of Pharmacy program, the Graduate Doctor of Pharmacy program, and finished that in 1996. And you want me to keep going?
Yeah. You graduated from the PharmD department, and now you're the head of the PharmD department.
I'm the director of the Doctor of Pharmacy program at UBC.
And so how did you do that?
And now we have a new doctor of pharmacy program there that starts in September, an entry to practice doctor of pharmacy program. And we have our graduate doctor of pharmacy program that's the one that I completed. And then and we're creating another new doctor of pharmacy program called the flexible doctor of pharmacy program. And there's a team of us like Glenda McDonald and Patricia Gerber and I that are doing that. And so that's the news. And so I've been a practitioner of clinical pharmacy, a hospital pharmacist in general medicine for these last 20 or so years, a little less, and teaching at the university and doing research in the hospital setting as well as the university context for all that period of time.
Okay. Well, first question, is it lonely at the top?
I would not know. I've not made it there yet. I don't even know what the top would look like. I had a thought the other day about that, kind of makes me think about that, like the idea that everybody has a boss.
Mm-hmm.
So someone might, this has nothing to do with me, but someone might ask that question. Maybe someday you, Adam, will have a chance to ask that question to, like, the Prime Minister of Canada,
mm-hmm.
or someone who people think of as being at the top, and they would tell you that they have a boss. They have, like, 30 million bosses, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a... I have no idea what being at the top would look like.
You don't feel
so
like you're at the top? It seems like from where I am, like, wow, you're at the mountaintops.
You're just delusional.
Okay.
But and you're very kind. Anyway, here's the real answer, mm-hmm. is that I feel like wherever I am, I'm not lonely.
Okay, good. Who do you feel is your boss?
Oh, geez. Well, the dean of the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences.
Oh, he comes in. Ultimately. Tells you what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Bob Dylan song, you're going to serve someone, right?
Yeah, isn't that true?
Okay.
Who's your boss?
You, for when I have to learn cardiovascular risk.
So you got a lot of bosses.
I have many bosses.
Mm-hmm.
But one day I do hope to be my own boss.
Do you?
Yeah. Okay. I'll serve the community, but they don't get to come in and tell me what to do.
Okay.
It's the good kind of service. I decide.
Okay. They will be your boss, though.
Yeah.
Won't they?
I guess so. Hopefully it's just a boss that I like.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I'll take that.
Wouldn't that be great if we all had one of those? I do.
Okay, can I ask you another personal question?
Yes.
Have you ever been in love?
Yes.
Do you mind telling us?
I feel like I could tell you lots about that and would love to. But I feel like, no, I don't want to use this podium to do that, to talk about those deep, intimate thoughts and feelings that I have.
Fair enough.
But yes.
It's enough to know that Dr. Lowen can love, too.
Very much so.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay, then let's get to the hard pharmaceutical science.
Okay, is it hard?
Yeah, it's going to be.
Okay.
It might be anyway. Well, the first question might be hard.
Okay.
How random is random?
Yes.
Is random like, can you have something more random than something else that's random?
I don't think so.
There's just a level of random. Either it's random or it's not.
As I understand it, and this has nothing to do with pharmaceutical sciences, and people in, out there in the real world can look this up on Wikipedia, as I say it incorrectly. But as I understand it, random is random, and that it's not. There's no extent of randomness.
Is there criteria to be like certified, quote, random?
I think the computer science people in the audience know the answer to this far better than I.
The mathematicians.
I'm fairly certain, yeah. Well, yeah, and I guess you're right, certainly the mathematicians. I think the reason I said the computer science people is because I have the only slightest modicum of knowledge about the need to generate a random number every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
in a software program.
Mm-hmm.
And having thought as a kid doing that and growing up that when I typed whatever that function was to get a random number, or in Excel, that I was getting a random number, and then learning as a grown-up that, in fact, those numbers that are generated are not truly random.
I had a suspicion of that. Not truly random. So if I just...
Meaning that randomness is a binary phenomenon. A number is a thing. Forget a number, but it's either random or it's not.
Okay.
That's what I think.
That's what I think, too.
You could look that up and find out that I'm wrong.
But then why I thought this has to do with pharmaceutical science is because a lot of the times what we rely on as scientific evidence in the pharmaceutical community has to do with randomized clinical trials, randomized control trials, placebo controlled. So in those trials, they usually separate everybody so that it tends to be pretty even in say, like the placebo group and the control group are both about the same age, both have about the same number of men and women. And my question is, do you think that's truly random?
So that maneuver you're talking about, the idea of randomly assigning people to one of two groups or one of three groups or however many arms there are in a clinical trial, one of the effects of that is meant to be that characteristics like the ones you just named get distributed fairly evenly between the two groups. That's an effect of trying to randomly assign people. Sometimes it turns out that those characteristics do get pretty evenly distributed between the two groups. Other times, by chance alone, there are imbalances between the two groups. If the randomizing wasn't truly random, then that would be another reason why there could be imbalances between the two groups. The idea that somehow the randomizing, that there was a conceptual finger on the scale that was tipping the probability of being randomized to one group or the other away from 50-50. So it's said that those kinds of things can happen in clinical studies. I can't say that I've seen very many examples of biased randomization, but it's conceptually it's possible. Do I think that's truly random? That, if you mean the assigning people to one group or the other, random in that case just means that there's an equal chance, as each person presents themselves, there's an equal chance that they'll be assigned to either group. In other words, that a one or a two, if there are two groups, is equally likely to come out of the envelope. Then I think that is easily achievable and is achieved in most properly done clinical trials.
Okay, but you agree that if that step is sort of missed or a bit compromised, then that's sort of the foundation, and everything after that, the conclusions we draw, sort of subverted?
If the step you mean is the step of making sure that there's a 50-50 chance that you get assigned to one or the other of the groups, is that the step you mean, if that gets screwed up?
No, I mean, if it's for some reason not like certified random, if anything, little thing creeps in there where it wasn't technically random, sort of all bets are off.
Yeah, I think we're saying the same thing. In the case of clinical trials, what we're talking about is, this is different than generating a random number between 1 and 1,000. The consequences, and I'm going back to what I was talking about earlier about generating a random number, the consequences of that being technically and mathematically not truly random may be totally trivial, and to a human, no human could ever discern the fact that it's that a series of 100 numbers between 1 and 1,000 are not truly random. They will look utterly and completely random to the human mind. So the fact that it's mathematically or technically not truly random may be totally trivial and unimportant. However, if we're talking about a very simple case like a clinical trial where you're only trying to make sure that there's a 50-50 chance that you get assigned to one group or the other, in other words, you're trying to make sure there's a 50-50 chance each time you ask for a random number between 1 and 2, meaning one or two, as long as there truly is a 50-50 chance that a one or a two will come up each time you ask, then randomization will be accomplished. I think you're asking, what if that wasn't the case?
Yeah.
Then true randomness is not achieved, and then you'd have to, it's fine to say, and I like what you're doing there. Mm-hmm. You're saying, well, does that mean, you said all bets are off.
Mm-hmm.
So
it all hinges on that one thing, sort of.
I'll play along with that. That certainly matters a lot. Yeah. That one thing is incredibly easy to achieve, though.
Well, like I said, I'm suspicious of random number generators. I'm always thinking, how random is that?
Tell me about that.
I don't know. It's just my suspicion. It's not very refined. Okay, but let me ask you. I imagine that you're an expert in sort of evaluating studies. I think of you as that. I'm sure you've evaluated, hundreds, thousands of randomized controlled trials.
Yeah, it's something that's important in practice, and so I have to do it a lot.
So in your opinion, sort of your professional opinion, what's the minimum number of subjects, like N equals what, for you to take it seriously? Like, I imagine you wouldn't take a trial of N equals 30, just 30 people, isn't really enough to suss out the difference.
Oh, okay.
Do you have a number that you...
Very important question. So And the answer to it is that no, I cannot have a number, and no one should have such a number, because how we know whether there are enough people in a trial is something that you can determine mathematically. And you decide that before you ever start the trial, how many people you're going to need in order to show an effect, and we say an effect size, an amount of an effect of a certain magnitude. And then the other thing you take into account there is how much uncertainty there is in your tool that you're using to measure the effect. So the N, or the number of people that you're, that is the right number or the minimum number to have in a study, has in the numerator, so in the denominator, let's say, of that mathematical equation I'm talking about.
Okay, on the bottom.
Yeah.
Denominator.
Yeah.
Yep.
It has the size of the effect that you're trying to find. So if you're trying to find a smaller effect, you need more people. And if you're trying to find a really big effect, you need way less people. In the numerator is this idea of sigma, the amount of uncertainty or standard deviation around your measurement instrument. And so an example of an effect size, if you're trying to find, let's say, a 1% absolute reduction in the incidence of heart attacks among people who've had a prior heart attack by comparing aspirin to some newer antiplatelet drug like ticagrelor, then you need, so a 1% effect size that you're trying to detect because you think that's a clinically meaningful effect.
Okay.
You need way, way more people to be enrolled in a trial like that than if you were trying to find a 10% reduction caused by ticagrelor compared to aspirin. So that's modifying that variable in the denominator, that effect size variable. Smaller effects that you're trying to detect with your trial, you need more people to detect them. If you're trying to look at a tinier grain of sand with a magnifying glass and resolve the detail on the surface of a tiny grain of sand, you need a more powerful magnifying glass than if you're trying to see, measure the size of the spots on a big piece of, on the surface of a big piece of granite. You may need a less powerful magnifying glass, maybe just your naked eye, to count how many black spots there are on a big rock. You may need a very powerful microscope to resolve the surface of a grain of sand.
So it is,
you feel it?
I think so. So it is feasible that, say, a study with only 12 people could be convincing, could be valid.
Yeah, so
detecting something huge.
Right. So examples are like antibiotics, right?
Yeah.
They tend to work. if you're attacking the right bug, the right kind of infection with an antibiotic that covers that kind of infection, you know, if you're trying to kill Haemophilus influenza as a, say, a lung infection, as a pneumonia, and you're using a second generation cephalosporin that has good activity against Haemophilus influenza, you're going to cure like 60, 70, 80% of those people compared to placebo, which would cure, I'm not going to say none, because a lot of people get better without treatment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big effect size. Right, the difference in the effect between a good antibiotic and no drug at all—that's mm-hmm. a big effect. And so you don't need a very big trial at all to show that that antibiotic produces that effect, because it's a big effect. It's in the denominator of my little mental equation here, and therefore the N is a small number. Like I said, if you're trying to reduce heart attacks and people are already on all the standard treatments, and what you're trying to do is add a new drug to that cocktail to squeeze a little bit more heart attack reducing efficacy from that recipe, then you're not going to reduce heart attacks by another 60% in all likelihood. You're going to reduce them by, you know, another 3 or 5 or 10% if your drug's really effective. And so you need a way bigger trial, like 5,000 people in it, let's say, compared to the, say, 50 people that you needed to have in your antibiotic trial because of this principle of effect sizes in trials. So that's why no learned person should have a number in mind as to what their minimum number of people that need to be in a trial before they'll consider the trial credible. The trial's credible if it has the number of people that the trialists explain to you thoroughly and convincingly and appropriately in their statistical analysis section that their calculations say they needed.
Yeah, you know what that reminds me of is lately I've been reading about the history of vaccines and vaccinations. Do you know anything about the...
I'm not going to pretend to. Teach me. They're pretty effective.
The story that stuck out to me was, you know, at first vaccines were not well accepted. And people got sort of the opposite of funding or respect in the scientific community. And what one person in particular was resorted to doing was infecting, basically going to the community of homeless people and prostitutes, purposely infecting them with syphilis, and then curing them. And yet he had just a tiny, I think it was like 10, 12 people, but it was 100%. Everybody that he gave it to was cured, and everybody he didn't give it to was not cured of syphilis. So what do you need to know?
Exactly. That's considered the most powerful kind of evidence, or the most powerful evidence of a cause and effect relationship between some intervention you do, like giving a vaccine or not giving it. And you know, Adam, all about the idea of the Oxford levels of evidence that we use to judge between different kinds of studies that we might have. And if different trial designs are trying to answer the same question, and let's say they show different results, are we confused? Well, no, we don't need to be confused, because we are able to say that certain trial designs are better at showing cause and effect relationships than other trial designs, and we should favor or be more likely to believe the results of trials that are higher up on that hierarchy of levels of evidence. At the very tippy top of that hierarchy is a thing called all or nothing trials. In other words, studies where, regardless of their design, either all of the people are cured or all of the people don't die when the intervention is given, and when the intervention is not given, none of the people are cured or all of the people die. Also, right below that, in that highest tier of levels of evidence, is randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews of randomized controlled trials.
That's level one.
Yeah. Level 1A.
1A. Okay, that's reminds me of a sort of a tangent that I might go off on.
Uh-oh.
When you said the levels of evidence, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
What would you say, say true or false? Anytime the quantification is necessarily illusory. I would say true. I say anytime you bring sort of reality and put it into a number, you're necessarily sort of capturing something less than that thing you're trying to describe. It's a bit of an illusion in there. You think you're dealing with the big picture, but...
I love that.
Right?
I'll buy that. You're by definition dealing with a facet of the thing.
Yeah.
You've chosen a facet of the thing to measure.
Right. That's why I'm so sort of weary of numbers and quantities.
Weary or wary? Or both.
At this point, I'm both. I'll tell you, I'm very wary, but also weary. But yeah,
do you
not have like a certain distrust of the numbers?
I don't have an inherent distrust of the numbers. I feel as though, at the same time, I feel as though when I'm looking at a piece of clinical research and trying to decide what I always have to decide, which is this valid? What are these results? And are they applicable to my practice, right? In the process of deciding that, I need the investigators, the authors of, let's say, a paper that I'm reading, to prove to me that they did their experiment in a way that is credible and is convincing. And that's the sort of whole art and somewhat science or process, let's say, of critically appraising pieces of evidence. In other words, making judgments about whether that's true. Did they do it in a way that meets the standard or is convincing so that I can know whether it's valid to begin with. If it's not valid, it can't be applicable to my practice, right?
True.
If it's valid, then if it's not valid, I don't care what the results are. So the first thing is to figure out, is it valid? Which is everything that we've talked about here so far, Adam, is right. About that question. And so, is it valid? What are the results and do they apply to my practice? So, do I start with the idea that it is all illusory? Do I start with the idea of being suspicious of the numbers themselves? Well, I guess in the sense that the burden of proof is on the investigators / authors. I'll say, I guess so. It's on them to demonstrate that the work they have done and published is valid. It's up to me to understand how to look at their results, and I'll say up to me to know how to interpret them. And then it's up to me to decide whether and how it applies to my practice or to practice in general.
Big responsibility.
It's a skill that you have to gain as a clinician if you want to practice in a way that the decisions you make for your patients are to your mind anyway, justified, that you have good reasons for doing the things that you're doing, that your reasons are rooted in evidence. And that's a paradigm that most practitioners in all health sciences nowadays adhere to. You don't have to adhere to that. You can just say, I'm a practitioner and I'm an artist and I treat my patients based on how I feel and how they feel, and I give them what they want, right? Those would be examples of not adhering to an evidence-based paradigm for your practice.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are rare, but most adhere to the idea that the decisions I make and the things I do in my patients can be justified based on evidence to the extent that that's possible.
You mentioned evidence. So I'm curious, do you think the scientific community has moved on, or the pharmaceutical science community has moved on from demanding proof, and now we're sort of happy with evidence? Like, how I'm thinking is, smoke is evidence of fire, but it's not necessarily proof that there's a fire. You can have smoke without fire, and you can have fire without smoke. So, you know what I mean? Like, do we just accept evidence now? And I thought sort of we used to demand proof.
It's a great question. A couple thoughts about that. One is, fire causes our human minds. Sorry. Smoke causes our human minds to infer fire.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you infer, what you're doing, I think this is the definition, but our Wikipedia fans can find out the ways okay. that I am wrong in
fact
what I'm about
this.
To say. But anytime you infer, what that means is you're seeing the effects of something in the universe, and you're working backwards to hypothesize about what the cause or possible causes of that effect are. That's inferring. So smoke causes you to infer fire. As you said, you can have smoke without fire.
Right.
That's most probable explanation for that smoke being there is fire. But smoke does not prove fire. So I'm right with you.
So then you
my other thought, though,
okay.
is because you said, have we moved away from demanding proof?
Yeah.
I think if you go back to the genesis of the origins of the philosophy of science,
mm-hmm.
that nowhere in that entire history of science did anyone claim that we could prove anything. In fact, I suspect you could go back further than the roots of science, just into the roots of philosophy and life itself, that we can't prove things.
I think I agree, yeah.
And way smarter and more scholarly people than me can fact check that, but I'm fairly certain people like Aristotle, like several thousand years ago, were saying things like that. We can't prove stuff. So no, I don't think we've moved away from requiring proof in science and in clinical medicine or in pharmaceutical sciences or anywhere. We haven't moved away from that because we never pretended we had a way to do that. What has moved is the tools that we have to make inferences have gotten better. So a randomized controlled trial is an example of just a tool. And it's a tool that it's a technology, if you will,
okay,
a thought technology, which is meant to be better than many of the other kinds of study designs or tools, meant to be better than those at demonstrating a cause and effect relationship between some intervention you do and the effect that's produced, in such a way that when we see the effect produced, so when we see the symptoms of schizophrenia in the arm of a trial where the participants got the active drug to treat their schizophrenia, when we see those symptoms get better in that group and we see them not get better in the placebo group, that's the thing we observed happening in the world, was those symptoms getting better in one group and not in the other.
Mm-hmm.
A randomized controlled trial is a tool that gives us more confidence in inferring that that effect, that smoke, was due to the drug that we gave. That there's fire.
Okay. Okay, I have one more question. It's about RCTs, and then we'll get to some music, okay? So here's the question. It's sort of a long. So say you read a study, a new study comes out, and it's all good. It's perfectly randomized. It's been done well. It's been blinded. They have large numbers, long spans. Every criteria that you look for is good. But the conclusion is that wearing yellow pants cures cancer. Or say something like the color of your pants will cure the cancer. So people wearing blue pants, it didn't work, but yellow pants worked. And you look for all the criteria, and you're like, no, this is checks out. Yeah, they're randomized. Yeah, they did their statistics well. Are you convinced by that? Do you think, yellow pants, who knew?
That's a great example of a situation where the intervention, the color of your pants, produces a surprising conclusion. And so that, thankfully, I don't encounter situations where the intervention is seemingly so utterly disconnected from the effect that I start out being completely skeptical that it could possibly have an effect. I guess I'll say that the world is a strange place, and there are lots of examples of things that we do producing effects that we didn't anticipate. So I approach that crazy example with a little bit of that mindset. So just because I can't think of a mechanism for that effect does not inherently mean, or does not, I don't start with the idea that because I can't think of a mechanism, therefore I'm skeptical of this effect. I think it's reasonable for people to demand some semblance of a mechanism before they'll quote unquote believe an effect. In fact, though, philosophically and strictly speaking, when a randomized controlled trial shows an effect like that, it teaches us nothing about what the mechanism for it was. And I'm sitting here speaking and trying to make up a plausible reason why the color of your pants could influence the cancer, right?
Yeah.
And I can't. But that doesn't mean someone with more imagination than me couldn't. And even in your crazy example, the people who set up that trial and the people who funded that trial and the people who wrote the introduction section of that write-up,
mm-hmm.
they had a reason. So there's that. I think the other way that I can answer your question is, yeah, sometimes results happen by chance alone. Effects are seen because of chance alone. And I think that may be part of the spirit of your question. And so a good chunk of the published scientific literature is reporting effects that happen by chance alone. The good bits report the probability that this effect that we just are writing up and reporting here happened by chance alone. That's what statistics is all about. It's all about being transparent about the probability that the effects you're seeing are because of chance alone. And that's where the whole paradigm or culture or expectations that we as scientists and clinicians have, that the probability that this happened by chance alone needs to be really low. How low? That's where the idea of it needs to be, you know, there needs to be less than a 5% chance that this effect was by chance alone.
Okay.
Do I believe it or not?
Yeah.
That's turning a probability continuum into a binary question, which it's fair to do. That's a human thing to do.
Okay.
But strictly speaking, I answer that by saying I would be 95% certain that this pants thing affected was the thing that had the effect on the cancer. Because, it turns out a certain color of pants filters light differently than another kind of pants, another color of pants. Or the dye that goes into that one kind of pants was actually causing cancer. And what you were not seeing was a curative effect of the group that wore the seemingly effective pants. You were seeing a harmful effect of the group wearing the pants that had the toxic yellow dye. You see those kinds of things?
You're saying
those might sound like ridiculous hypotheses, but it was a ridiculous question to begin with, and it illustrates that, yeah, even then, it's a strange world, and there's things that happen that don't jump to mind immediately.
But you might at least think maybe it's not necessarily the color of the pants. Maybe the color of the pants is related to something else, something maybe not easy to see, and that thing is what's doing it. Okay.
And the one color of pants was manufactured in this place by this corporation and using this process, and the other color of pants, by necessity, was manufactured in this other place because that's how you get the best pants. And there are other parts of those processes that were responsible for that outcome. What outwardly looked like the difference, which was the color, is not responsible. The magic of all of this is that the randomized controlled trial tells us nothing about the mechanism for the effect. It can teach us nothing about mechanisms of action of drugs to look at randomized controlled trials. Nor can different colored pants trials tell us about why the different color pants produce the different effects.
Do you think there are, of all the trials that have been done on drugs and medications, do you think there are some out there where they found a difference and they concluded that the difference was due to the drug intervention, when in fact it may have been due to something not plainly visible? It could have been not just chance and not the drug, but something else we missed?
Yes. Just simply speaking, if you demand a 95% level of confidence, or you allow a 5% chance of making a type 1 error, an error where you're saying there's an effect when there's not, if you just say that you'll allow for there to be a 5% chance of that, which is how conventionally most trials are set up, that amount or less, then it's just simply speaking true that 95% of the trial results that you see published are reporting an effect that is real, and the other 5% are reporting an effect that is not even real. That's a very, very simplistic way of putting it, because it ignores the myriad other forces that influence whether a trial ever gets done, whether a trial ever gets finished, whether a trial ever gets published and put in front of our eyes to even see. But just to reduce your question to distill it, there's lots of studies out there that report an effect where that happened by chance alone.
Okay.
That's called making a type 1 error. And we allow that 5% of the time we'll make a type 1 error. We don't allow for you to make that kind of an error more than 5% of the time. But as long as we're 95% sure, that's considered sure enough. By science as a discipline, as a convention, by clinical medicine, it doesn't mean that every individual clinician needs to just accept that and be comfortable with that. Some people may demand a higher burden of proof. Other clinicians demand a lower burden of proof. they'll look at a study and go, well, this suggests that there might be an effect. It did not reach statistical significance, but I see a trend here that I think is interesting. And in my mind, I can envision a mechanism by which this drug might produce this effect. So I'm going to try this in my patient. So people take that standard and use it both ways.
Okay. Okay, we'll be right back with more Dr. Peter Lowen, but first here's some Angel Olsen, Iota.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
A show dedicated to playing psychedelic music from parts of the spectrum, rock, pop, electronic, as well as garage and noise rock. Sundays, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
Hey, this is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts. all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM on the dial in Vancouver. This is Transition State. I'm your host, Adam, and with me is Dr. Peter Lowen. Hi, Dr. Lowen.
Hey, Adam.
Feeling good?
I feel great.
Dr.
How
Lowen,
do you feel?
I feel awesome. I've really enjoyed our talk about the nuts and bolts of science numbers. But what I want to ask you about now is music.
Okay.
What kind of music do you like? What have you been listening to lately?
I like lots of different kinds of music. I know everybody says that. There's somebody I listen to that's kind of my fave, kind of my go-to, speaks to me most, which is Glenn Hansard. He's the former lead singer of an Irish band called The Frames, and he speaks to me, so I love Glenn. He's been part of an outfit called The Swell Season as well, which is him and a Czech person named Markéta Urglová, and they made an amazing music movie. I think it's 2006. It won the Academy Award for Best Song.
What was the movie?
Once.
Okay. Finally, it drops.
That's Glenn and Markéta. They're in it. They're the stars of it, and I think he wrote it, and it's all his music. And
the music in
and
that
stuff.
Movie is amazing.
You know it. Yeah. Okay. So I kind of love him or them and The Frames and Glenn and Markéta, and they just, it speaks to me and it touches me, and I think it's beautiful. And you know, you have artists that you go to when, I don't know, you feel like you need music the most. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, not just that throwaway background music that you sometimes might want to listen to, which you might like, but if I need to dig in, if I want to, or share, then kind of Glenn's my guy.
Okay. Do you like singing?
Oh, man. I'm going to say yes. Yeah, I do. I do sing. And but to say that just means I do it. The world can judge whether I can do it competently, but I like to create songs, and I play the piano and a very little bit of guitar, but I mostly play piano, and I feel like the things that I care about sometimes coalesce into lyrics, and then sometimes I can be inspired to turn that into a song. And then, because I'm a bit of a kind of computer nerd as well, I have, you know, the right software and hardware to record that and turn that into something that can be shared with others. So,
nice.
You feel me?
I was going to ask you, do you have a preferred mode of, like, personal expression? But that sounds like, that counts as...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, no, I love to sit down at the piano, you know, by myself or, you know, and just be with it and see what happens, and you know, obviously just improvise and express myself that way, maybe just to myself. If I'm with someone who can appreciate and enjoys that, then I love to be able to do that with a confidant like that.
What do you say?
It means a lot to me.
What do you think we give our listeners a little special treat right now, and me and you do some singing? Shall we?
What are we going to sing?
Here, I'll start us off. Can't read my, no, he can't read my poker face. She's got me like nobody. Can't read my, no, he can't read my poker face. She's got me like nobody.
My poker face. Oh yeah, okay, Lady Gaga.
We both have good day jobs.
That was, I think, amazing. I'm glad that's been captured for eternity, for posterity. I'm glad you don't use tape anymore, where there's a chance that that could decay, because I think the world's going to benefit from that.
Digital archives. Two words.
How about
digital
Gypsy? Archive. Can you sing Gypsy by Lady Gaga?
Can you start it off?
I'm a gypsy. It would be cool if this was like a radio station where you could actually just play the thing that we're pretending to do a horrible impersonation of. But I guess that can't really be done.
We could have thought ahead and planned that, but oh well. I think the listeners will appreciate that, honestly.
Oh, I can't imagine why not.
Okay, one last question. I asked you before about your favorite drug, and I have a better question now. If you had to live your whole life and you only got one drug, start to finish, which drug would you choose to have access to for your whole life?
Ibuprofen.
Okay, good answer. Okay, well, we're out of time, unfortunately. I think we have time. I want to thank you definitely for being here, taking the time to support Student Radio, Dr. Loewen. It's greatly appreciated.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to have this conversation with you, Adam.
Before we go, I think we have time for one more song. Do you have any requests?
Yeah, there's a song I love that I'd love if you would play.
What is it?
It's called You and Me
by
Dallas Green and Pink.
Dallas Green and Pink. Okay, I think I have it here. So this is Dallas Green and Pink on Transition State on CITR. Until next week, stay pharmaceutically sound and stay cool.
You and me were always with each other before we knew was ever there. You and me, we belong together, just like a breath needs the air. I told you if you called I would come running across the highs and lows and the in-between. You and me, got two minds, I think, as one, and our hearts march to the same beat. They say everything, it happens for a reason. You can be flawed enough, but perfect for a person, someone who will be there for you when you fall apart, guiding your direction through the dark. Oh, that's you and me. You and me were searching for the same light, desperate for a cure to this disease. Well, someday better than others, but I fear nothing as long as you're with me. They say everything, it happens for a reason. You can be flawed enough, but perfect for a person, someone who will be there for you when you fall apart, guiding your direction when you're right. The dark. And they say everything, it happens for a reason. You can be flawed enough, but perfect for a person, someone who will be there when you start to fall apart, guiding your direction when you're riding through the dark. Oh, that's you and me. Oh.
Hi, my name is Jonna.
And my name is Claire.
Together we make something called
Yuck!
And we're not eating Dunkin' Donuts.
We're listening to Dunkin' Donuts.
We're feeling Dunkin' Donuts.
That was JoJo and the Fugitives from Toronto, from the excellent compilation Jamaica Toronto, Soul, Funk, and Reggae, 1967-75. It's cut off on the sheet that I have. I think it's those years. Anyways, Jamaica to Toronto, this excellent comp that was put together looking at the relationship between Jamaica and Toronto. And that was the song Chips, Chicken, Banana Split. And I send that out to my favorite garbage dad, Joseph, JoJo, in his own right.